This is Trudy Hickey from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
Finally, we visit the home of Ashley Bryan, the artist, storyteller, and children's author who lives in a house on Islesford, overflowing with toys and puppets and stained glass windows made from shards of sea glass. Born to parents who emigrated from Antigua, Bryan was raised on a noisy, multi-ethnic street in the Bronx.
And I lived in a very varied community of blacks, of Irish, Italians, Polish, a large Jewish population because of Bathgate Avenue, which went all the way from where near where I lived up to all the way along up to Tremont Avenue in the Bronx. But in growing up at that time, during the Depression years, there was the WPA, which was the Works Progress Administration, where artists were hired to teach in communities throughout the country, drawing, painting, music. And my parents sent us out to these free programs, simply saying, learn to entertain yourself. That was it. Learn to entertain yourself. And that's so we all were drawing and painting and playing instruments. And that was in the Great Depression years of the 30s, you know. So it was a very special time. And there were many things introduced to me by the teacher at the time, because I can remember my first real sense of the way I could work with color came from opening up the Impressionists to us as students in the class. But it was also at that time, we could on Sundays go to the museums, because that was it was just an open city in that sense. There weren't the fairs that we'd have today. So I'd often go to the Metropolitan Museum, the Bronx Zoo, the Botanical Gardens, whatever. And we had access to culture in that very direct way. But you had to really pursue further. So with my parents, of course, with the opening the whole world of the spirituals, knowing the contributions of black slaves, of how incredible that under a system where they were not allowed to read or write, they could create the song of that magnitude. It was the only material they could use, the freedom of the mind. They were not given materials to write or to draw, and they were not permitted to. And so it was just extraordinary that in the freedom of the mind, they could create that body of work.
One of the things you brought into children's literature in this country that I think might have been, if not lacking, sparse, was an appreciation for the African folktale. What is it about that material that works so well for you and for the children that you're reaching?
Well, it just tells you that stories are universal. There are different shapes, different forms, different characters, different motifs, but you can recognize them. You can do a story that has a child who's badly treated. The father gives him something, a cow or whatever, to go out into the world with, and the cow is enchanted in some way and helps him, and he comes back in great acclaim and fortune. It's a basic motif, the child who goes out into the world and then becomes recognized because of the kindness and the spirit of just being a decent person that he or she is. And you have all sorts of stories to explain things about how the sun came into the sky, why the stars are in their forms. And these motifs are picked up by people throughout the world. So African folktales relate to universal experiences in storytelling. The tricks, the motifs, they have Spider and Ansi, one of the most popular tricksters in Africa, although you also have the hare, the tortoise, and you have the turtle, all the tricksters at times. But those motifs are found in all cultures, that in different forms they may take. But the small one outwitting the largest big force, so to be able to make his or her way, is just found everywhere. And it's very exciting. It's very exciting to find. I work from documents which have preserved a motif, because the stories were not written. They were in an oral tradition. And when they were taken down to get written transcriptions of these 1,000 tribal languages, they document the form, but they have nothing to do with storyteller. I take the form that interests me, and then I become the storyteller using all the techniques of storytellers throughout the world, bringing whatever I feel will now bring it as a written story to a feeling of the oral tradition.
In a lot of your children's stories, you wouldn't know what color these creatures are. They have millions of colors, just as I see on your canvases in front of us. It's not a story about black versus white or black not being in the inside white society. But there is one book which won the Coretta Scott King Award called Beautiful Blackbird.
Yes.
Now, that world does seem to me to speak directly to children about the importance of including everybody in their own little worlds. Can you tell me that story, and I'm going to ask you about it.
Oh, well, in that story, Beautiful Blackbird, I was drawn to that motif because the birds of all colors, they meet together. And when Ringdove asks who's the most beautiful, they're all colors of the rainbow. None of them have any black on them. But they all say, Blackbird is the most beautiful, how very black he is. And so when I came upon that motif, I said, I'm going to tell that, because there are so many stories, the negative aspects of black. You come last, and that's the lousy color that's left, and so you get that. Well, so here was a story which sang to black. And so I used that story because the birds then see that his colors, they radiate all colors in the sun, and they then would like something of that themselves. Well, when Blackbird then decorates them, they sing out, our color sport a brand new look, a touch of black was all it took. Oh, beautiful black, uh-huh, uh-huh. Black is beautiful, uh-huh. Well, they realize that in when we see things or when we're inspired by others, we take them in, we are marked by those good things of others because we don't do everything on our own. We see things that we feel will enhance us, and we work to acquire that and make it a part of our own selves and lives. The basic motif of that story is how we all draw upon the inspiration of others, the good things. I tell the children, the bad things, forget it. Let them roll off your back. They will not make you become the good person you would like to be. But when you see things that inspire you, that help you, you are marked by those as you take them in. Every day in school, what you are learning, the good sensitivity to others, all of those are marks in your character of who you are. And that is the outreach of that story, although it can be taken in many ways. It's singing of the beauty of black, which has not been accepted in that way. But it also is telling you we draw from the inspiration of others. We see something that is good, and we want to emulate that and make it in ourselves.
Here you are on a pretty frantic schedule still. If my math serves me, you would be in your early 80s at this point, although I wouldn't know that if I hadn't looked it up, because I'm looking at a man who looks like he's about 65.
It's blazoned out. They carry on. I'm 83. But I don't go by years. I go by the excitement of what each day can offer. And I think in that kind of focus, I'm always ready and excited about what I am doing and how I can sort of try to get to the shape, the form, what I'd like to realize, which I don't come near.
I'd like to ask you then how it is that living on this island since, what, 88 or so, something
yes.
like that, on this tiny little island.
Year round, yes.
How do you think that's influenced the way you live and work, being here?
Well, even when I wasn't living here, it influenced how I lived and worked, because you see, there is a center of quiet that one strives for in the midst of a city. And what I would get here, when I went back to New York City, I would always work toward that. Now I can, because it was clearer to me here, you see. I didn't have to work in that way to get to that quiet center. I could just go out and walk through the woods. I could walk along shore. I could look out to see the sky and be reminded, what is essential? What is it? The earth, the sky, the sea, and our care of those basic elements that we have put here to maintain and sustain. And so, but it's direct here. When I decided that I would live here, it was because it was direct. But I also knew if I could not tap that essence in New York or wherever I was, that this place was not for me. I had to be able to get to it wherever I live.
There you have it. Just a sample of what makes Maine such a great place for writing and for reading. The Maine Humanities Council thanks you for listening on this, its 30th anniversary, and wishes you many years of blissful browsing in your living rooms, local libraries, and bookstores.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening and thanks for your support.